Support for On Point and the following message come from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Home plays a big role in your life. That's why Quicken Loans created Rocket Mortgage. It lets you apply simply and understand the entire mortgage process fully, so you can be confident that you're getting the right mortgage for you. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Kimberly Atkins, Chief Washington Reporter at the Boston Herald, and this is On Point. Black men in America are facing disadvantages so extreme that some would call the situation a crisis. In this country, at staggering rates, black men are less likely to finish high school, more likely to die from heart disease, less likely to be employed, and more likely to be incarcerated than white men. Is it past time to buck the notion that black men themselves are to blame? Do we all share the blame? How about the solutions? This hour, On Point, the lot of black men in America and what we can all do to help improve it. You can join us on air or online. As a black man in America, what challenges do you face? And how does society stack the deck against you? How does it make you feel? And how do you deal with it? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from Ann Arbor, Michigan, is Alfred Young, Jr. He's a professor of sociology at the University of Michigan, and his research focuses on low-income African Americans, and his book is Are Black Men Doomed? Professor Young, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Kim. Thanks for having me.
So what made you want to take on this research focusing specifically on black men?
Well, it's been a 22-year engagement at this point. And I thought quite some time ago that some serious changes were unfolding for black men in America. As I had gone to college and then graduate school, I saw fewer and fewer people like me following the same path, and decided early in my career that I was going to invest in a study of what was going on with black men in urban America. I'm a product of East Harlem in New York City, and I've certainly witnessed, not just research, but witnessed men experiencing struggle. And I thought that the most important thing I could do as a researcher was try to contribute back to that conversation. I had no idea 22 years later I'd be having very much the same conversation. But that's the case.
So you talk a little bit about those experiences you had growing up in New York, specifically the Central Park Five case. Talk a little bit about how that informed your desire to look into this issue.
Well, in a lot of ways. First of all, I grew up in a neighborhood adjoining where most of the Central Park Five young men lived, and in fact lived in the same apartment building as the aunt of one of those men. And I remember vividly being in the neighborhood a few days after that incident transpired. And like a lot of folks, we thought, what were these guys up to? Why did they do this? What does it mean for our neighborhood, our community, for them to do something like this? So a lot of us bought into the understanding that they were at fault. And so in much the same way in which American society buys into notions about black men and masculinity, folks in the hood, so to speak, felt the same way. And over time, watching how the litigation unfolded and the investigations unfolded and realizing that a lot of mistakes were made by the police. In some ways, the men themselves made some mistakes in reporting activities to the police or appearing before the police. And years later, to find out that they were innocent of the situation made me think, if people in the very community where this activity unfolded could initially think these men were up to no good and should be pursued because of that, then what does it mean in American society overall for people that may have no contact, no consistent interaction with these kinds of men? What kind of images, ideas, understandings do they have that need to be challenged and need to be questioned?
And you write in the book that even those professing to be empathetic to black men often emphasize material resources and what they must acquire from more privileged others in order to enact changes in their own situation. What did you mean by that? And how should people who are empathetic with the plight of black men in America react?
What I meant by that is quite simply that we need to understand that black men themselves have agency. By that I mean they have the capacity to respond, to react in ways that are conducive to their own positive ends as well as for the positive ends of others. So this notion that they must continually be served or directed or informed or guided, that approach is certainly important. but understand that we can learn from, adapt to, react to them in different ways. And so let's think about what kind of agency, what kind of power and influence they have over their own lives, and not just regard them as misguided or misinformed.
And Al, I just want to give a quick refresher for our listeners about the Central Park Five case. In a nutshell, say what that case was about and what the outcome was.
Well, it involved a very aggressive assault and rape of a white female jogger in the northeast end of Central Park. So that part of Central Park borders the East Harlem, Harlem communities. And it occurred in the midst of what was reported to be a night of activity, aggressive activity by youth in Harlem, in East Harlem, apparently running through the streets and assaulting people, challenging people. But at the end, it turned out that one individual had aggressively raped and almost killed a young woman who was jogging late at night. And her body was found ultimately in the late evening after the assault had taken place. And there was almost a SWAT-style pursuit of black and Latino men on the street corner immediately after this incident, this effort to round up people and determine, you know, who did this. And it turns out that various men were indicted, in some cases men who were sought after by the police, in some cases men who went to the police department to support their friends who had on their own gone to the police to report their activities that night, none of which having to do with a rape or assault of a woman. But ultimately, five men were charged and initially convicted of assaulting this woman. Questionable evidence throughout the case. A lot of commentary by political leadership. The then mayor of New York City, the governor of New York City, Donald Trump, others calling for the indictment of these men, the incarceration of these men. And we find out years later, through some investigations, through the continued pursuit of what happened that night and why it happened, that none of these men were involved in the incident in any way. And that the eventual person responsible, who had been incarcerated for raping other women, was found to have testified, or at least reported while incarcerated, to other offenders what he did, and was eventually charged. And these five young men were released from prison, well into their adulthood, I should add.
Okay. We already have a lot of comments coming in through our website. I want to read a couple to you and then get your reaction, Al, on the other side. Josh writes, in a time with unprecedented outreach and programs available to the black community, when one black man can gain entrance to an Ivy League university with a rap album and another by writing Black Lives Matter 100 times on his application to Harvard, please tell us how black men are doomed and how it's all the fault of whites. Another listener writes, are black men doomed? No, unless one wishes to put politics over justice, which tends to be the case. What's your reaction to them?
Well, first of all, I think about and have studied hundreds of black men that represent the 15 or more million black men in America. To find one or two or a handful of cases that are alternative to any common issue, circumstance, or concern doesn't speak to the larger population. We can always find one or a few of anything that fly in the face of patterns that that unfold for all. That being the case, you'll find black men at Harvard. You'll find black men in prominent positions. You'll find black men everywhere in America. My point is that we continue to find black men subjected to a kind of image and interpretation that may rest upon the behaviors of a select few who engage in criminal activity, who do the kinds of things that cause us necessary concern, but the millions of other black men bear the consequences of the public image created around those few. And that's not erased by the handful that get to Harvard, the handful that have had elite education like myself.
Okay. Al, I want to get your reaction to a new study that came from researchers at Stanford, Hartford, and the Census Bureau. It was reported today in the New York Times. It shows black boys raised in America, even in the wealthiest families and living in some of the most well-off neighborhoods, still end up earning less in adulthood than white boys with similar backgrounds. Their earnings are more aligned with those from working-class backgrounds. How does this fit in with your research?
Well, that study in particular, I need to dig deeply into and understand the design and structure of the project. I get the findings, and I'm not surprised by the findings. And there are a lot of factors that go into the results that were revealed. for privileged black men as well as for lower income black men. This notion that they are seen as less worthy, less capable, and much more threatening than other social beings plays a role into what opportunities are made available to them, what employment prospects come their way. So I'm not at all surprised that black men of even more privileged backgrounds experience outcomes that don't mirror the outcomes of people of their same class status.
So you break down a lot of different areas, from health to employment to education. Before we get to our break, I want to start with the idea of health and well-being. We know that black men are more susceptible to some ailments than others. In terms of putting the onus on others within society to help black men, how can they help when it comes to something like health issues?
Well, health is in large part, up to individual behavior and individual responsibility. There are also social circumstances and conditions that affect one's health. Being subject to scrutiny, surveillance, observation is a threat to your physical well-being. And that's when the rest of us play a role in creating conditions that affect black men. So the notion of having to navigate everyday life, being perceived as a threat, a nuisance, a problem, the kind of encounters that black men have with police officers every day, and I've had them myself as a younger black man, add to the kind of stress, the kind of strain that affect one's health. So health is certainly far beyond an individual level condition. It's affected by the behavior of others and the way in which they interact with other people. And it's that dimension of the health crisis that I think we all have to pay attention to. What is going on in American society that causes stress and strain, unduly so for black men?
Support for On Point and the following message come from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Chances are you're confident when it comes to your work, your hobbies, and your life. Rocket Mortgage gives you that same level of confidence when it comes to buying a home or refinancing your existing home loan. Rocket Mortgage is simple, allowing you to fully understand all the details and be confident you're getting the right mortgage for you. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states. NMLS ConsumerAccess.org, number 3030.
This is On Point. I'm Kimberly Atkins. We're talking about how society stacks the deck against black men in America and what we can all do to help mitigate that imbalance. You can join the conversation. What disadvantages do you face as a black man? What factors do you see as behind those disadvantages? And what do you think can be done to correct them? Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. My guest is Alfred Young Jr. He's a professor of sociology and an ethnographer at the University of Michigan. And his book is Are Black Men Doomed? We have a lot of callers waiting to talk to you. First up is Lonnie from Charlotte, North Carolina. Hi, Lonnie.
Hi, Kim. I told you, the screener. I just was released from prison like 12, I did 12 years and I was released like maybe a little over a year. And it was hard for me to find employment. And I had to move to three different states before I can actually find a job. And now I'm living in North Carolina. So, I mean, the challenges that we face is people don't seem to forget. Society won't say, well, yeah, you served your time, you know what I'm saying? You paid your debt to society, let you move on. But people, you know, society don't let you do that. So it's kind of hard. And then you find yourself in a position to where it's either your brain switches into survival mode, to where you do what you know that you can do to survive, you know? And that was my point that I was trying to make. And it was just hard for me to find employment until I actually moved away and come to another state, a third state, I'm sorry.
Lonnie, thank you for your call. Troy is calling from Hartford, Connecticut. Hi, Troy.
Hello, Kim. How are you? I just wanted to thank you for doing this topic and give respect to your guest today. But I wanted to talk about every time, from my point of view, I'm a liberal African-American male, 47 years old, educated. Every time I make a political stand, I get shunned by people on the right, even called racist for standing up, not just for African-Americans, but for all people. And the second point I wanted to bring up, I'm also a businessman. I own my own business. It is very hard, I believe, for an African-American male to have and run his own business, to garner support from all communities, but especially from our own community.
Al, what do you think about those topics, re-entering society after being incarcerated and trying to run a business, start a business, and add to the economy?
So we've got two men from the opposite ends of the class spectrum that both typify the kinds of concerns, questions that motivated writing this book in the first place. So in the case of Lonnie, he's exactly what I'm talking about in the book in America's inability to allow for redemption. Now, I would not apologize and make excuses for whatever Lonnie did that allowed him to end up being incarcerated. He didn't do so in his comments. He's done his time. He's trying to adjust back to society and is denied or blocked that opportunity. That's the case for so many men. And given the incarceration rates affecting black men, it means a social condition of chronic crisis in terms of transitioning back into life. And I think here, a critical moment for American society to think about what's going on here. If a man has paid his dues, done his time, served his sentence, how can we be prepared to allow him to enter back into society? It doesn't mean that we neglect the fact that something wrong happened at some point in time and a sentence was served for it. But it does mean that we've got to appreciate that there are many men capable of responding in more healthy, more positive fashion to society if given the opportunity. And we've got to work as a society in turning away from this notion of black men as incorrigible, as eternally committed to crime and delinquency, as unable to be positive contributors to life, even if at some moment in their lives they've done some wrong things. In the case of Troy, everything about Lonnie's situation leads to the lack of trust, comfort, confidence people have in black men who are capable of running businesses, who are capable of earning incomes, who have to interface with a client base or a customer base that's got to believe and feel comfortable in them. And I fully understand that, as he put it, even African Americans feel that way. Again, go back to the point I raised earlier, is being a young man in East Harlem, feeling that five men were guilty of raping a woman and they weren't. I accept and understand that black America itself has to undergo transformation in how we view black men. But the onus is upon all of us, black or white, or whatever we might be as members of American society, to rethink how we come to understand black men and to challenge ourselves in trying to think differently about them.
All right, Tom is on the line from Manchester, Connecticut. Hi there, Tom.
Yes, I'm calling in, speaking as a different perspective of second-wave baby boomer, black male, college-educated with 3 degrees, and single and child-free, you know, by choice. But I think we get kind of caught in the middle, too. I try to do what I can as a community or concerned, you know, citizen with speaking out against not just racism, but with diversity in the schools and the curriculum. And I've been doing it, you know, 30 years. We're introducing, you know, literature and other groups, well, I guess commissions or forums that I've, you know, attended, you know, with an open mind to hopefully bring in a different perspective. But I guess sometimes it can get, you know, tiring. I know you've talked about, you know, the crime rate and that, but even the ones that have achieved, sometimes, I don't know, among our own race, if we become, I would say, our own worst enemies, but, you know, I've got mine, you can get yours, such as, you know, Supreme Court Justice Thomas, the way he's voted sometimes, and criminal justice stuff, you know, makes me cringe. I know he's worked hard, but he's against affirmative action, but he's a product, you know, of it. And I know with the alt-right, when I heard Richard Spencer saying it's a white man's country, I found that appalling, because my late father fought in World War II in a segregated, you know, army, so I'm a beneficiary of it, and I'm saying we'll never be subservient to, you know, any group. And I think it's, you know, your voting and civil rights are important, but also, you're right, education.
Well, Tom, I want to give Al a chance to address that issue of, you know, I got mine, now you get yours.
And I fully understand why many people assume that stance. Right? If we're talking about a group of people whose historic existence in this country has been denial of opportunity, then when the opportunity presents itself to get ahead, to earn an income, to achieve some kind of stability, that's an ultimate desire for a lot of folks. I get that. The great work to be done, and the caller represents this in some ways, is to recognize the challenge in trying to extend that to other people. I would not argue there's a simple or even immediate way of transforming the condition we live in now around black men, that it's going to take consistent investment in first thinking differently about them, then providing them with opportunities to improve their lot. And some won't. Some may be unwilling to do the right thing, so to speak. Others may adapt a mindset of acquiring whatever can benefit them at the expense of other people. That's the American way of life. And so we're actually asking for a radical transformation in mindset and ideology. And I get the challenges out of there. I think at the end of the day, the best one can do is try to be resourceful and helpful to a few people in their communities, right? If you can be a source of important change or assistance to a few or several in your immediate space, I applaud you.
Okay. I want to bring another voice into the conversation. Joining us now from Washington is Malcolm London. He's an activist, poet, and musician. He's on a national music tour right now, and he'll be making a stop in Boston, where our program is produced, this Friday, March 23rd. Malcolm, welcome to On Point.
Thank you, Kim. I'm glad to be here.
And so what do you think about the discussion so far? Are black men doomed, and whose responsibility is it to help them?
I am an optimist in any space, and so I wouldn't say we are doomed, but we are in a critical situation. By the sheer numbers and statistics that we look at every day, by the disproportionate rates of incarceration, disproportionate rates of interactions with the justice system, police killings, what have you, access to resources. It is real. At this point in our country and in our time, there is no debate whatsoever as to the disadvantages that exist by the sheer creation of, or by the sheer lived experience of having black skin. That is real. It is fact. I think one of the major things right now, and what we're talking about, is the criminalization of black men, and this perceived generalization. Right? We talk about stereotypes, and right now, generalizations of black men get them murdered and killed, as what folks are talking about. That no matter where you are, Harvard or on the west side of Chicago, you are a bullet hole away from an exception. You are perceived to be a scary person, or even if you're in the White House. And so that is a project of our consciousness that we have to change and shift. And in order to do that, we have to be able to say, oh, this is a reality, that no, not all black men are criminals, though we live in a country where mostly white men commit more violent crimes because there are more white men in America. And yes, there are disproportionate rates at which people get arrested, but those are not correlated with crime and violence. And that there is a project, and that there is a neglect, and I would say an intentional process in which black men are being arrested. Mm-hmm. And so I want to shout out this morning Will Smith. Actually, because he just got an Instagram. Shout out to him. And I think this can be explained. I do think that the onus and responsibility is on the entire country. It is. It has to be if we want to live in our values and our ideals. However, as an educator, as a poet, as a young black man, to there has to be a shift and sort of this paradoxical ideology, which is, yes, all things are difficult. Yes, there are cards stacked against me. Mm-hmm. But how do I shift that? And Will Smith was talking about, it's somebody's fault. It's America's fault that black people are in poverty. It is America's fault that black men are disproportionately arrested, and black people and queer folks, all black folks are experiencing what it means to be black in a scary way. That is America's fault. But the responsibility has to be on us to do it if we want to truly be free and capable and whole to deal with our trauma, to deal with the system that which keeps us oppressed bars us from opportunities and resources. We do have to create them for ourselves. All right. We do have to do that.
So. All right. And I want to get to some of our callers. Stephanie is calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Stephanie, welcome to the conversation.
Hello, Kim. Thank you for taking my call. I was calling because as a mother of young black men, I am constantly furious by the way the media portrays African Americans in such negative ways. And I fear that constantly being bombarded and being exposed to all these subtle messages, it really shapes the mind of not just the greater society, but of how African American boys see themselves. I feel that they internalize this. And, you know, I used to, when my kids were little, I'd say, you know, let's look at Lion King. Disney does this constantly on their sitcoms and everything. So, I don't know.
All right. Thank you for your call, Stephanie. On the same issue of that, the family and how family members address the issue of the plight of black men in America. In 2015, the New York Times created a short documentary called A Conversation with My Black Son, where parents revealed their struggles with telling their children that they might be targets of racial profiling by police. Here's a clip of one father explaining what he has to tell his black son in the event that he has a run-in with law enforcement.
These are the questions you can ask. This is who to call. This is what happens if this bad thing. It's not like, please, master, don't whip me. No, it's like, excuse me, sir, what is your badge number? I'm going to film this.
Al, what is it specifically about black men that makes this a particular challenge? I mean, everybody is probably nervous when they have an encounter with a police officer who's armed.
Again, it's a sense of threat. It's the feeling that black men are uniquely capable of doing harm or destruction above and beyond other folks. And in the case of black boys, they're being adultified, as we say in academia, in the face of police and other parties, that children are regarded as threatening or harmful. And that just exacerbates the pressure that's going on. So to hear this mother talk about the work that she has to do, for me to know many black parents that spend considerable time talking to not just their boys, but their girls, but for the sake of this conversation, their boys about how to survive, and I mean in a literal sense, how to survive public life as a black male, means an enormous challenge, an enormous burden that you put on young people to think about what it means to navigate everyday life, how you walk the streets, who you talk to, how you talk to those people, how you appear to those people. All of which are tied to some of the violence that black males have been subjected to in society, but become these additional burdens that you've got to navigate in everyday life.
Carlos is on the line from Atlanta, Georgia. Hi there, Carlos.
Hey, Kim. And hi, Al.
Hello.
Hello.
Go ahead, Carlos.
Hey, how we doing? Okay, I think you made one profound point in regards to the media, how they illustrated these five black young men in Central Park in Harlem. I was a resident there at that time. But I want you to know what you're saying is basically the media is not a friend of the black community, the way they project us. One of the points is, every time, you know, think about this, how the media project us as being shiftless, lazy, or possibly somebody who's angry. And there's always a reason why they do this. That top 5% is to hide what they're doing in that Me Too movement. You know, I mean, people are always oppressing other people. They oppress black people. They oppress women. But when they expose another person of being not of caliber, of not of having high morals, it really camouflage what they do.
Malcolm, what do you think about the media's role in the perception of black men?
Oh, I think it absolutely plays a huge part. I'm from Chicago. Every night there's a face that looks like mine on the news without fail. While simultaneously, you know, I love Chicago and there is a lot of violence there, but there's just as much, if not more, beauty. And very rarely do I see cameras out when, you know, there's young people in the city throwing open mics. There's young people in the city protesting and growing community gardens in their city. And so, yeah, absolutely. The media, you know, gets to choose. But then you must ask it ourselves, who controls the media you know, who controls the images of people that are in the media?
This is On Point. I'm Kimberly Atkins. We're talking about the societal structural challenges that face black men in America and the radical rethinking that we all need to do more for these challenges to be overcome. You can join the conversation. How can black men's prospects in America be improved? What needs to change and who needs to change it? Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. My guests are Malcolm London, a poet and activist, and sociology professor Alfred Young Jr., whose book is titled Are Black Men Doomed? Now, Al, what are some solutions here? If it's incumbent on society to play a bigger role in changing where black men are in America, what is it exactly that they need to do?
Well, I argue there's a twofold agenda. First is wherever we stand in society, whatever social institutions we're a part of, to take the opportunity to reconsider and then try to learn better about the black men in our midst, whether it's schools, the workplace, the communities we live in. Think about the assumptions we have about these individuals and get to know them, invite, in a literal sense, a conversation with them to get to know them better. It doesn't mean you'll, at the end of the day, have the same beliefs, the same ideas, the same interests, but you will come to understand people in a more provocative, a more substantive way than what the stereotypes contribute to. Beyond that, then, thinking carefully about what we mean by societal intervention. A caller earlier today talked about the large amounts of money that are spent on these men. Well, relative to other social groups, that's not the case. Right? That's become a kind of cliche way of talking about government intervention in the case of black men. There are a whole lot of dollars spent on a whole lot of people, but even in the context of black men, much less so than other groups. And so this notion that people are living off the government or are already well rewarded and such, what more or what else do they need? That's not the case. The most amount of money spent on black men is to incarcerate them. And that exacerbates the problem that we're talking about. Mm-hmm. So let's think about what we mean by investing in a population that really hasn't been invested in, save to keep them incarcerated. And let's think about how we can come to understand these men as individuals rather than as constituting this public threat.
Malcolm, one listener tweets, the question alone makes me sad. Are black men doomed? But you spoke about optimism. What positive steps do you see taking place, and what would you like to see more of?
I think that my favorite thing about blackness and black people, particularly in Chicago, is the ability to be malleable, that even in the face of constant funerals, even in the face of a mayor and a city that closes their schools, that covers up a death of someone that looks like them, they still have the ability to laugh and to dream and to grow regardless. And I think that's been true in the black experience. So we've been in worse places before and have maintained this hopefulness. And as a poet and as an organizer and organizing and poetry being the antidepressant, I have to believe that things will get better. And so I see that, particularly in Chicago. I see young people. I want to shout out Asada's daughters in Chicago. Artists are at the forefront of trying to reimagine what it means to be a black man. And I think even deeper, what gives me hope is also wrestling with our own internal processes, because I also want to uplift that there is a lot of attention on black men, because there should be more and more of it. And I think more black men particularly should also pay attention to themselves and ask themselves, what does it mean to reimagine my identity, not to be a trope or not to try to mimic what I see on TV or what success is? And that also means we have to talk about violence against women, black women in particular. And I think through the lens of trying to unlearn, we can learn how to reimagine to be better ourselves.
All right. Jen is on the line from Madison, Wisconsin. Hi there, Jen.
Hi, Kim.
Go ahead. You're on.
I wanted to share that Wisconsin happens to be the state in the United States with the highest disparity in racial disparity and incarceration. So we incarcerate more black men as opposed to non-black men. And within Wisconsin, Dane County is the worst county in Wisconsin, so we are the worst county in the worst state in terms of incarceration disparity. And my question to Investor Chugan, when you said that the onus is on all of us, as a white person living in the county where this is, you know, we're ground zero for this issue, what can I be doing, and what can I be encouraging white people to do to fight the mass incarceration of black people?
Thanks for that question, Jen. What do you think, Al?
And again, it goes back to what I said earlier. The extent to which you reach out, connect to, talk with, get to understand black men better, the extent to which you encourage your peers, your professional associates, the folks you come into contact with on a daily basis that may have a set of assumptions, a set of stereotypes in mind, that's the important work to do on the ground. So understanding what you understand about the situation, even as you phrase or presented the case of Wisconsin in comparison to the rest of the United States, means you're already in touch with some important understandings of what's going on. Have those conversations in your community. Have those conversations with your peers. Have those kind of conversations with people that may not either know or care to be involved in the lives of black men in the way that you are, and encourage them to do so, to learn about, to appreciate what is really going on around these men.
Dewan is on the line from Nashville. Hi, Dewan.
Hi, Kim. Thanks for taking on and giving voice to such a critical topic. I really appreciate this. And as a black man in the U.S., I first want to say we have made considerable progress in academia, workforce, travel, and entrepreneurship, given the historical context of how black people have been disenfranchised in the U.S., And so to answer one of the earlier questions, no, I do not believe black men are doomed. But as one of the callers mentioned, there's a lot of great work happening in our communities to mitigate and address the realities of growing up black and poor in the U.S. and, you know, all the baggage that comes with being exposed to poverty and crime and, you know, those things. But I'm a proud graduate of an HBCU, Florida A&M University, to be exact. But before I could walk through those doors, I had to be prepared to pursue higher education. And unfortunately, I think I'm an anomaly in regards to being prepared and provided real access to opportunity. So for those of you who want to know, how can I help? Well, give and give back financially if possible, and help publicize the great works that is being led by HBCUs and programs like the 5,000 Role Models, which Dr. Frederico Wilson has been championing for so long, and the Urban Prep Academy. I heard a caller mention Chicago, and the I Have a Dream Bayview Foundation. These are all programs that helped me get to where I am today. I worked in academia and had a considerable amount of exposure in traveling and a lot of opportunities. But before I could get to that point, it took a lot of, you know, preparation to address and mitigate those issues that I faced as growing up, you know, in inner city poverty and being exposed to a lot of violence in the community. So please give back when you have an opportunity to programs that are working diligently to address these issues and help people navigate away from the railroads that have been created to push them into incarceration.
Yeah, Malcolm, talk about these community resources. I mean, the saying is it takes a village to raise a child, right?
Absolutely. The village just has to want to be invested in that. So, you know, I mean, to his point, there's a lot of people in Chicago. You just have to find them. One of my favorite and important voices in the world, I think, is Miriam Kaba, and she always says that, you know, we don't, when we come to this place of despair, we always think, oh, well, we need new ideas. We need to just think of something else. And there are people, there are ideas. We just need more people. And so today on this NPR, if literally we say go do something, go do it. Like literally make that a priority. There, or if you don't find the organization, create the organization. But they exist. They do. We in the age of mass information. I know in Chicago, the reason I became an organizer was because I read the Black Panthers' history. story, and the first thing they did was knock on their community's doors. Mm-hmm. I was 16 years old and said, wow, I never thought about going to my community and talking to people, and I did. And the first thing I found was a church on the west side, connected to a church called the West Side Health Authority, and this group called Daddies for Shorties, right? Just men, mostly formerly incarcerated, who had children and wanted to be fathers to other folks. There were never any news cameras, never, rarely any resources. There are people. And we have to stop the lie that perpetuates, that says we don't, that mm-hmm. says black men are doomed, that says there aren't Alfreds in the world, there aren't Malcolm Lindens, there aren't callers who are concerned. There has to be a shift. And, but in order for there to be a shift, we also have to really say who's in control of the narratives. And as a poet, I believe we have to reimagine our own narratives, create them, tell them, and keep them alive.
And Al, how has society changed, if at all, for the better? I mean, in the last decade, we saw the election of the first black man as president of the United States. Right now, there is a lot of excitement around the film Black Panther, an all-black cast, which is crushing box offices and getting great reviews from across society. Is this, are these things changing the narrative of black men at all?
Well, they're changing to the extent that there's a larger public conversation about black men, a different conversation about black people in general. And as much as I've talked about the importance of conversation, that's important. And I certainly don't want to discourage or deny the radical transformation in black men appearing in public conversation because of the presidency of Barack Obama, because of some developments in film and media. What I do want to acknowledge, though, is that sometimes that conversation, if not taken further, if not advanced to the point of view of trying to have healthier, more positive understandings of black men, can result in the kind of defensiveness or anxiety that, in my view, we're experiencing today in America in a post-Obama presidency. So we've got to be careful about simply having the conversation and more focused on what capacity we have to change our thinking about them, change our manner of encountering them.
Okay. Al, we've talked a lot about black men, but do these same principles apply? I mean, I'm a black woman. I've faced difficulties throughout life, even though I came out okay. What about men of color who are not black? Do these same principles apply to us?
I think in many ways they do. One of the points that I've tried to make as a researcher is to be clear and focused on a particular problem or a particular aspect of a problem, such that some advance can be generated around it. This does not deny that other people experience important challenges and questions. I spent a good deal of my career as a researcher engaging researchers who study the plight of black women, and I recognize there are critical concerns there, by extension for other folks of color, by extension for people that are socioeconomically disadvantaged. There are a lot of people experiencing a lot of problems, and I do not deny that. I also try hard not to place some specific kind of hierarchy on who's got it worse or who needs the intervention more immediately. A lot of folks need help, and a lot of folks need to be understood differently. I've sort of grounded myself in one population that I happen to hold membership in to advance that possibility. But that doesn't deny that there's a lot of work for us to do in America for a whole lot of people.
All right. Roderick is calling from Baltimore. Welcome to On Point.
Hi, Kim. I don't want to take up too much time, but I wanted to stress an issue that's important to me, and that is that there's an issue that I feel that never really gets talked about, which is the culpability of my white brothers and sisters in the whole race relations problem. So take, for instance, in a couple of weeks from now, we're going to celebrate the 50th, or at least commemorate the 50th anniversary of the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King. Dr. King was shot in a suit and a tie. I consider myself an anomaly. I graduated from an Ivy League. I'm a musician. I'm an artist. I've concertized all around the world, and I'm still profiled. There's the problem of race here in this country. It does not lie solely with the black man, obviously, but with, as President Obama stated, it's an American problem. That until America comes to terms, until we have our atonement, which we may or may not be ready for, you know, Dr. King was assassinated 50 years ago fighting for some of the same things that we're discussing. And even though I think that the discussion mm-hmm. is an important and it's a vital one,
yeah.
I feel that we're just spending our wheels.
Well, Malcolm, what do you think about that?
I totally agree. You know, the issue when we talk about there is an issue with white supremacy in this country. The birth of this country began on it. And so there has to be some participation by those who benefit from it to end it and to dismantle it. And so when we talk about, you know, what do we have to do for black men? You know, in order to, I am not the one, you know, who I didn't create the poverty I was born into. I didn't create the image I was born into, or the criminalization. And so in order to tackle it, we have to, I appreciate the caller. I agree with everything you said.
And Al, just in the last 30 seconds we have, what's the final takeaway you want listeners to take from your book, from your thesis?
That first of all, black men aren't doomed. So many other callers and commentators have said that. But the work to be done falls upon us. The critical thing to think about is what we must do, not simply what they must do.
Okay, Alfred Young Jr. is a professor of sociology and an ethnographer at the University of Michigan. His book is Are Black Men Doomed? Al, thank you so much for joining us on the show today.
Thank you for having me.
And Malcolm London is a poet, musician, and activist. He's on a national music tour right now, and he'll be making a stop in Boston, this program's home city, this Friday, March 23rd. Malcolm, we really appreciate your time today.
Thank you for having me, Kim.
And you can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. You can also follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm Kimberly Atkins. This is On Point.